The Infrastructure Show is brought to you by Wyss Janney Elsner Associates, engineers, architects, and materials scientists, solving complex problems in contemporary and historic structures since 1956. Learn more at wje.com.
Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
On July 6, 2013, a freight train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded in the downtown area of Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, killing at least 42 residents. Subsequently, a special emergency meeting was held in Washington, D.C. by the Federal Railroad Administration's Railroad Safety Advisory Committee to discuss additional rail safety measures for hazardous materials transport.
The agenda of the emergency meeting included a safety advisory issued jointly by the FRA and the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, also known as PHMSA. Directed to railroads and shippers of hazardous materials, the advisory included a number of recommended actions to help reduce transport risk. Here today to discuss this topic of safe transport of hazardous materials is PHMSA Administrator Cynthia Quarterman. Cynthia, we're very pleased to talk with you this morning.
My pleasure.
First, can you tell us something more about the role of your agency?
Certainly. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA as it is commonly referred to, is one of the administrations within the Department of Transportation. Here at the Department of Transportation, our primary goal is transportation safety. That's our number one priority here. With respect to PHMSA, our mission is to protect people and the environment from the risks of hazardous materials transportation. And that includes in all modes, whether it be by road, by rail, by ship, by air, or by pipeline. To do this, we establish national policy, we set and enforce standards, educate and conduct research to prevent incidents. We also prepare the public and first responders to reduce consequences if an incident does occur. Our vision overall is that no harm results from hazardous material transportation. We cannot accept any death as an inevitable consequence of transporting hazardous materials. So we work continuously to find new ways to reduce risk towards zero deaths, injuries, environmental and property damage, and transportation disruptions.
Have you always worked closely with the Federal Railroad Administration, or is the collaboration a result of increased movement of North American oil by rail?
We have always been working closely with the Federal Railroad Administration. Here at PHMSA, since we issue the hazardous materials regulations that apply to all modes of transportation, including air, rail, highway, and water, we work closely with many other DOT modal partners, such as the Federal Railroad Administration, the Federal Aviation Administration, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, the Maritime Administration, and also our former sister agency, which is now at the Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Coast Guard. In collaboration, we all promote hazardous material safety and try to enforce the hazardous material safety regulations. We also conduct joint hazmat investigations whenever they're necessary. And with respect to the movement of North American oil by rail, we have been working for quite a while with FRA to address this increased movement.
Can you tell us what the major elements of the safety advisory that your agency and FRA drafted in August?
Absolutely. It went hand in hand with an emergency order that was issued by FRA. Some of the main elements are that in future, shippers properly classify crude oil when it's being moved. The second element is that hazardous materials offerers and carriers have in place the appropriate safety and security plans so that they adequately address any known or potential safety and security risks in their movement. The third element really went to this particular incident in that it addressed the securement of unattended equipment and the potential role for human error in rail incidents. That was sort of the first step out of the box. We also began an internal effort that we named Operation Classification, where we would do a series of spot inspections, unannounced inspections, and data collection and sampling to ensure that the crude oil that was being moved was properly classified. We started that. We announced it most recently. We had started it, in fact, before the incident occurred. We also put in place an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in September. This is a rulemaking that we had in process for quite a while and were able to publish shortly after the La Magantic incident that sought comment on amendments that we had been considering to modify the construction of certain DOT specification tank car standards and enhance operational controls for rail transport. In addition to that, not too long ago, November 20th, we sent out a second joint advisory bulletin with FRA to really focus on the safety and security plan to reinforce to shippers the need to properly characterize, classify, and select a packing group for these what we call Class 3 materials and to revise their existing plans to take into account the recent incident that occurred. We are now in the process with FRA of going out and inspecting the existing security plans to see what problems we might find in those plans, and we may do more things once we have an analysis of, you know, our investigations thus far.
So I looked at the September advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which, as I read it, seemed to focus on the DOT specification 111 tank cars, which they're a variety of cars that are very commonly used for transporting flammable liquids like crude oil and ethanol. And the process is interesting and complex. Could you tell us a little bit more about how this rulemaking process works and kind of explain to us the relationship between your agency and the 8 petitions to which that rulemaking responds?
This rulemaking initially started with a petition from the Association of American Railroads asking us to adopt a change in the standard to the DOT 111 tank car. They had been meeting internally and come up with some enhancements to the rail car and petitioned us to include those enhancements in our regulations. We and FRA have been looking at those standards in the past. We want to make sure that whatever the new proposed standards are sufficient to meet all of our needs. So this particular rulemaking, called an advance notice, is to ask a series of questions, to ask questions about the petitions that we got in, but to go beyond just the question of the tank car. I think it would be a disservice to the public if we only were to change the tank car standards, because it's almost impossible to create a tank car that would be sufficiently strong to withstand an incident like the one that occurred at Lac Megantic, where the rail car is thought to have been going more than 60 miles per hour. So that has to be only a piece of a solution. We also have to consider additional operation issues that might be necessary to enhance the safety of tank cars. And our rulemaking process at this point is to ask a series of questions in the ANPRM. The comment period closed on December the 5th. We are in the process of analyzing those comments. The next step in the process could go in many different directions. We could come forward with a notice of proposed rulemaking, which would then set forward proposed standards, as opposed to asking questions as we are now, proposed standards moving forward, which could adopt the AAR standard tank car. It could make modifications to the standard that AAR has come up with. It could suggest operational changes to rail lines to deal with the movement of these hazardous materials. And then there would be another comment period for folks to weigh in on that, followed by a final rule from our agency.
So what motivates a group of stakeholders to bring to your agency a request for, if you will, an additional regulation?
the recognition that the current standards are perhaps not as strong as they should be or not sufficient.
So what this looks like to me as an outsider is a very collaborative approach to developing rules and standards. Is that a fair description?
It absolutely is. I mean, the petition process is really an opportunity for those in regulated industry or others in the public to come to us and say, we see something that's good out there that you don't yet have in your rules, and we'd like to have you adopt them. So it is a very collaborative process and a positive one.
Is the rulemaking process that you're going through right now, is it unique to PHMSA, or is it common across the regulatory agencies in the federal government?
I think it is common in its form. I think it is somewhat unusual for petitions to be offered. I think we are unique in that we get quite a few petitions on our rules.
There is a clear invitation. The words that I remember reading in the notice was an invitation for the public comment. But as I understand it, the real, the highest valued public comment really comes from the technical stakeholder community who are very much hands-on in this business. Is that fair? So you're really getting them to do some technical analyses.
Yes, that's true. Not to say that the public comments are not of value. Often when you have a very technical area like this, it is members of the regulated community, whether it be the railroads themselves, the owners of the tank cars, the shippers of crude oil, who know enough about the technical details to be able to provide really technical input into what we should do about what essentially is the package here, which is the tank car itself. The public may raise issues, for example, with respect to notice movements of hazardous material or other issues that are of importance to them. But from a technical aspect, it's usually those industries that provide those kinds of comments.
We pause our podcast for a moment to thank our sponsor, Wiss Janney Elsner Associates. Engineers, architects, and material scientists who are solving problems throughout the built world. Visit their website at www.wje.com.
Does PHMSA have its own internal capabilities to analyze the benefits and costs of these regulatory changes, like the new specifications for the DOT-111s?
We do have some internal resources to evaluate that. We also rely on outside consultants. We, of course, have the Federal Rail Administration as well, who have a wealth of knowledge on this front. We also can do research and development efforts to analyze, and FRA has done some of that with respect to the proposed standard that AAR has put forward. So we have a number of resources available to us to be able to analyze both the technical side and the financial question of how much will it cost to change the standards.
The principal controversy, as I understand it, in that particular advance notice is whether a new standard, if it were to be developed, would apply only to new tank cars or to all existing cars. It seems like that's a huge choice. How will that be resolved? That is, who ultimately will make that decision?
Ultimately, we will make that decision. And it is a question, because obviously changing over to the new standard will not eliminate or deal with the fact that there are tens of thousands of tank cars that are being used to transport crude now. But that's also a place where operational changes across the industry could have an effect. So we will be looking not only at new tank cars, but we will be looking at whether it is necessary to retrofit the existing tank cars. That is obviously where the real costs come to bear in this question, because retrofitting would be an expense.
I imagine it would be a substantial expense. How does that get worked out? Who pays for it?
Who pays for it is an internal industry question, whether it is paid for by the shipper, who essentially pays through it in the rates for leasing these tank cars, or someone else. That is a question that would be worked out through that mechanism. So ours would be to determine whether or not it would be beneficial to the country from a cost-benefit analysis based on the risks versus the cost of retrofitting.
If we look at both at interstate pipelines and railroads, my understanding is that they're common carriers and they have some obligation to move any reasonable freight that's offered to them regardless of the risk. Is that a fair description of the situation?
Yes, both carriers are common carriers, and they are obligated to accept hazardous cargo that's tendered to them so long as they are tendered in compliance with legal requirements. We are not sort of the oversight agency for the common carrier piece of that, but that is in fact the case.
Yes, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my understanding of the situation is that the railroads are motivated to advance the standards on technology or to improve operations because they really are not in a position to turn away some of this freight and probably don't want to be because of the value to the nation.
Absolutely. I think whether you're a railroad or a pipeline company, it is to your advantage to ensure that the movement of these hazardous materials is safe, because otherwise the public, the government, nobody will permit it to happen. And from an economic perspective, you want to proceed with transportation of those goods, so you have to meet the safety requirements.
So with the increase in hydraulic fracturing in the continental U.S., there's more demand for transport of crude oil. What are the pros and cons of rail versus pipeline for moving that oil?
Well, we here at the department are not in the business of choosing winners or losers with respect to any modes of transportation. Our job is to ensure that however it moves safely. Now, there have been lots of articles recently that ask the question, which is safer, which is not. We're not in the business of deciding that question. We just want to make sure it's safe when it moves.
So your issue is not which is safer, but can they each be made safe, and your job is to make sure that each is safe?
Absolutely, correct.
So in your work in the pipeline area, do you have the capability to do field inspections?
Oh, yes, we do.
Okay, so that does make your function very much parallel to Federal Rail Administration.
Yes.
Do you have a sense that there's enough, or maybe this question's out of bounds, do we have the pipeline capacity we need to handle the demand for crude oil production in the continental United States?
Well, as you know, there has been a great boom in production of oil and gas in the United States. No one would have thought 5 years ago that we would be here today being probably the number one producer of oil again, and with gas supplies that take us, you know, perhaps 100 years into the future, which means that our existing infrastructure is not yet up to speed to carry all of that new production. And you will see, I'm sure you have seen in the public, that there are many requests for new pipelines going across the country, and we're seeing on the railroad side that there are many new uses of the railroad over the past, since the past few years, the amount of crude oil that is traveling by rail has quadrupled. North Dakota is now the second largest oil producer in the country, outpacing Alaska, right behind Texas. So, of course, the infrastructure has not caught up with that yet.
So some interesting problems ahead, or challenges ahead, I think, for your agency. Isn't that fair?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you see technologies on the horizon that can make a substantial reduction in the risk of transporting hazardous materials?
Well, we have great hope on the rail side that once positive train control comes into place, it's a requirement for all big risky movements of hazardous material, that will make a difference. On the pipeline side, there are technologies out there for inline inspection of pipelines. That technology has been growing and improving over the years. It is not yet a silver bullet, so we are really pressing on the technology front for more tools to analyze these systems. I think that will be the big winner in, you know, for safety in the end of the day. Of course, all these systems have to be operated by human beings, and human error continues to be a leading cause for incidents. It's not so much the systems, it's just people making mistakes along the way because we're all human.
So we're all human and we're all always going to be human. What kind of things do you guys work on in order to reduce human error, or what thoughts do you have about that?
Trying to make more intelligent the existing tools. For example, on the pipeline side, there are all sorts of alarms and alerts that happen in the control room, and it's a learning experience. You know, if you get too many alerts and alarms, you begin to phase out when you hear that they happen, so you have to change the tolerances. So it's a constant learning exercise to figure out, okay, we have these alarms and alerts, but human beings are no longer reacting to them because there's so many, so you have to change the tolerances there. And we are on the hazardous materials side. One of our thoughts going forward is putting more research and development into the human error piece to try to put in backstops so that when people make mistakes, technology might be able to help them.
It's an interesting problem, and as you say, it's a problem across all modes of transportation and freight and passenger transportation as well. You've given us some really valuable insights today, particularly into the complexity of the regulatory process as well as the challenges you face. We haven't heard that much from your agency, but we've learned a lot today and puts us in a better position to follow it. So thank you very much for spending the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. I always say here, PHMSA is the most important agency you never heard of.
That's a very good description, but I think we've changed that, at least for the people that listen to this podcast, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.